Next, we are not going to proceed with hearing or work session on Senate Bill 220, nor on House Bill 3670. We are going to work on our two work sessions first, and then we're going to move to the hearings, beginning with Senate Bill 713, and then 704, and then 773, 925, and the last will be House Bill 2551.
Thank you.
No, I didn't. Yeah, that's okay. Either way.
Okay.
Yeah. I just wasn't sure, so I figured it was better.
I'm going to open the work session on 2335. If Mr. Swank would come forward, please.
Good morning, Chair Walker, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel with the State Court Administrator's Office. Let me tell you where we are with 2335. Actually, until Thursday, I thought everybody had signed on to the amendments we'd done. And Friday, I got some comments from both the DAs and the OCDLA that were different from what I'd heard up until then. Let me tell you where you are and what our recommendations are. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to apprise your counsel. Normally I would, but I had to leave Friday to meet a dishwasher repair person who showed up at an odd time at our house.
They come in their own time.
They do. Where we are is, first of all, the main portion of the bill is a housekeeping bill that is our bill, and I don't think any of the provisions of that bill are controversial. As you recall, what we did was we introduced an amendment to address two things. One of them, when jury fees are paid, and these are the dash one amendments, and I don't think that part's controversial, and that would add a section 13, and then sections 14 through 17, which introduced provisions that would address the Brownhill case and how people would get confidential jury lists if they wanted to mount a jury challenge, basically defense attorneys. And what I heard from the OCDLA, at least until last Thursday, was that they were thrilled we were introducing a procedure. They thought a procedure was necessary for how they would get them, and they have one sticking point. And that sticking point, if you have a copy of the amendments, is on page 4. I brought extra amendments if you need them. Page 4 of the dash 1 amendments, lines 28 and 29. And that says that the court may order release of the jury records if the court finds that the jury records sought or likely produced relevant evidence in support of the motion. And then this morning when I got in, I had an email from Josh Marquis that said their concern was that it does not appear to require anything more than an unsupported claim that the jury panel is improperly constituted. It allows for ex parte application for a motion, the existence of which could not possibly prejudice the defense's tactics, and it appears that the ODAA would encourage the filing of such motions in almost every possible case. For that reason, we are concerned that there will be a significant fiscal impact. Finally, it appears that, as drafted, it will allow the defense attorney to halt deliberations of a sitting grand jury. I don't agree with Mr. Marquis, who is the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I don't agree with his assessment for a couple of reasons. He mentions two things, and if you go to page 5 of the amendments, first of all, he says that it's an ex parte motion. If you start on line 30, it says the party making the motion shall serve the motion and supporting affidavit on the other party, which obviously means it's not an ex parte motion. The other party is going to get a chance to respond. And he says that it would be unsupported and appear to allow the defense attorney to halt deliberations. Again, if you look at Section 17, 136.005 currently says that the district attorney or defendant in a criminal action may challenge the jury panel on the grounds that there's been a material departure from the requirements of law governing the selection of juries. We have not changed that standard. That standard exists. So it's currently a challenge that they can make on the same standard. All we have done is establish procedures. In essence, I think what the district attorneys are arguing is it's too easy. What the Oregon criminal defense lawyers are arguing is that it's too hard. What we've done, we think, is establish a standard that allows a judge to be a gatekeeper because the person has to come forward with some showing, some fact that indicates that there's a problem. If they indicate the problem, there's some kind of problem with an affidavit, then the judge can order the release of the confidential records, and they can proceed to use those to try and find a jury challenge. Our suspicion is that once they get the confidential records, they're not going to find anything. We already have Kathleen Correll, who's a defense attorney, who got records under the Brownhill case some 2.5 months ago, and we haven't heard anything since she got them. We believe the procedure is just that, a procedure. It doesn't deal with any of the larger issues that you heard Rose Jade talking about, like workers' comp and those sorts of things. It doesn't make a change in the way that the legislature has addressed juries. It provides a method for a judge to be a gatekeeper on a reasonably low standard, to provide protection for the jury list so they don't end up on the internet like the motor vehicle license stuff did a couple of years ago. So I guess I'm encouraged that we've struck a middle ground that provides a procedure to address the Brownhill issue. But I want you to be aware of that. It is an amendment. I can answer any questions. We would encourage you to adopt it and pass the bill out. But if you've got concerns, I'll try to address them.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Swain? Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2335. I'm going to open the work session on 2771. Counsel, could you give us an update on 2771, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2771, as you recall, we heard the original hearing several weeks ago, and then last week, Representative King came back and gave us the dash two amendments. At that time, our schedule was pretty full, and so we didn't move them. And you'll recall that the main thing that the dash two amendments do is appropriate $5,000, which, although I haven't sent it down to fiscal, I assume would make a minimal fiscal impact statement. So that's what's going on with that.
Okay. All right. Committee, are there any questions or discussion on this amendment? This is a dash two. Dash 2, it appears, incorporates the dash 1, does it not, Council?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Okay. Any discussion? Would entertain a motion on the amendments?
Madam Chair?
Shetterly.
I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2771, sorry.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly moves the amendments to House Bill dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2771. Any discussion? Hearing none. Is there any objection? Nobody discussed. I figured there was no objection.
Do we want the dash 1 amendments too?
No, they are incorporated in the dash 2.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I move House Bill 2771 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2771 with the dash 2 amendments to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Looks like a great idea.
I could agree. Thank you. Roll call, please.
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. House Bill 2771, as amended, is passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Carrier?
I'd be happy to carry this.
Representative Lowe?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 713.
As you'll recall, members of the committee, House Bill 713, I believe it was Senator Castillo was here last week to tell us about this bill, and we ran out of time. And this deals with international adoptions and the voluntary adoption registry.
Thank you, counsel. Todd, I can't pronounce your last name. I don't want to ruin it. From Holt, would you please come forward?
Thank you.
And please tell me how to pronounce your name.
Quapish.
Quapish? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Unfortunately, Susan Cox, who drafted this testimony, is unable to make it, but she asked me to present it on her behalf. On behalf of Holt International Children's Services, I thank the House Civil Law Subcommittee for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 713-A, exemption of international adoptees from Oregon law disclosure, and request that my testimony be submitted for the record. Chair Walker and members of the committee, my name is Susan Sungun Cox, the Vice President of Public Policy and External Affairs for Holt International Children's Services. I would like to begin by expressing our appreciation of Senator Susan Castillo for sponsoring Senate Bill 730 and to co-sponsors Representative Phil Barnhart and Vicki Walker. Senate Bill 713-A would eliminate the requirement of Oregon international adoptees from having to register with Oregon's Voluntary Adoption Registry, also known as the VAR, in order to receive identifying information about themselves and their birth parents without consent of the birth parents. Under current law, statute states that only if both an adoptee and birth relative have registered with the VAR can identifying information be released to the interested party. The registry is passive and means a match will not be made if only one party registers. The voluntary adoption registry was intended for domestic adoptions finalized in the state of Oregon. An unintended consequence of the VAR is that it equally applies to international adoptees whose adoptions are facilitated by an Oregon agency. For adoptees born abroad, it is unrealistic to expect their birth families will know of or be able to comply with the requirements of the VAR. This legislation has enormous implications. For example, Holt holds the adoption records of approximately 50,000 individuals from nearly 20 countries and its Oregon headquarters in Eugene. We place approximately 1,000 children for adoption within U.S. families each year. For majority of these adoptions are the families living outside of Oregon with fewer than 150 in Oregon. Although many of these adoptees or their families have never been to Oregon, their permanent records adoption records are in Oregon under responsibility of their placement agency, who are required to follow the statutes governing the release of identifying information. The present reality is an ever-growing number of Oregon international adoptees wishing to search for birth families are simply circumventing the VAR system. They go directly to the internet, travel to their birth country, put ads in newspapers, or use the underground networks to find their information. These efforts provide no safeguards or protection of the social service system and makes adoptees vulnerable to abuses, either intended or unintended. The professional support the adoption agencies can provide can make all the differences in the experience for adoptees as well as their families. In 1993, the United States joined 66 countries to become the signatory to the Hague Convention on Protection of Children and Cooperation in Respect of Intercountry Adoption. Nearly a decade after the Hague process began, the United States Congress ratified the Hague Convention and the treaty was signed into law in October 2000. Article 30 of the convention mandates that all adoptees shall have access to their adoption records insofar as permitted by the law of that state, and that the central authority sending and receiving countries shall ensure records are preserved. It is on behalf of thousands of adoptees that Holt requests this exemption. Senate Bill 713-A is of great interest to many international adoptees and advocates of adoption reform. Holt would like to acknowledge services to children, families, and the Coalition of Oregon Adoption Agencies for supporting SB 713-A, recognizing the sensitive issues surrounding this requirement for international adoptees whose adoptions are finalized or facilitated in Oregon who seek information about their history. Holt urges you to support Senate Bill 713-A, the exemption of international adoptees from Oregon law disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you bringing this information to us. Are there any questions?
I would like to make a comment, though.
Certainly, Representative.
Thank you for bringing forward this amendment. One of the most pleasant experiences I ever had as a practicing attorney was to do a Holt adoption for a family that was desperate to have a child. And I really wanted to thank you for the work that you do to bring families together. I like that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
Kathy Ledesma.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the program manager for adoption services at the State Office for Services to Children and Families, otherwise known as SCF. And I am here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 713-8. 713 modifies ORS 109-440, which is the statute governing the operation of Oregon's Voluntary Adoption Registry. The Voluntary Adoption Registry, if you don't know, is the confidential repository for identifying and non-identifying information related to the parties to all adoptions for which petitions are filed here in the state of Oregon. SCF has responsibility for maintaining and operating the registry, as well as for setting the rules for how private adoption agencies in Oregon operate their portion of the registry. This includes providing access to the registry by persons who are legally entitled to the information stored on it. Under our existing statute, in order for a person to obtain identifying information from the registry about another party to their same adoption, that other party must give consent. Senate Bill 713A creates an exception to this requirement for foreign-born adoptees whose adoptions are finalized in the state of Oregon. In other words, these adoptees would have access to information about themselves and their birth parents without the consent of the birth parents. SCF believes that 713A creates a positive modification to the Oregon Voluntary Adoption Registry that will benefit foreign-born adoptees, and that it does so without compromising the rights and protections that the registry under our current statute affords to the adoption triad, which consists of the adoptee, the adoptive parent, and the birth parent. We commend Senator Castillo, who filed this bill, and Holt International Children's Services, on whose behalf it was filed, for proposing the statutory change that is sensitive to the particular needs of foreign-born adoptees whose adoptions are finalized in our state. We don't believe that Senate Bill 713 will have any fiscal impact for us, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Ms. Ledesma? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here that wishes to speak on Senate Bill 713? I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 713. We are not going to work session today on that bill. I'm going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 704. Charles Stern, please. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Charles Stern. I'm the Amhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. I think last week you heard Senator Shields kind of run through the high points of this bill, and we're here just to say we support this bill. It was developed so much in a collaborative effort between clerks and various people of the clergy, we support this bill.
Thank you.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stern. Are there any questions for Mr. Stern this morning? Mr. Stern, you've had to testify so many times this session. I really appreciate you coming in again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 703? Okay, we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 703. We're not going to 704. Thank you. We're not going to work session on that one. We're going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 773.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 773, as you'll recall from last week, Senator Brown gave us a presentation on that, and it deals with tort claim notice when the child is in the custody of either the Oregon Youth Authority or SCF, and it would exempt those people from doing tort claim notice.
Thank you. Kathy Osborne.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne, senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project is in support of Senate Bill 773. What Senate Bill 773, the engrossed version, would do is if a child or youth is under the age of 18 and in the custody of SCF or the Oregon Youth Authority, and the tort is caused by SCF or the Oregon Youth Authority, would mean that those youth would be, or those children would be, exempted from filing a tort claim notice. Tort claim notices are required to give either state or county agencies notice that a lawsuit might be filed against them. This does not limit the tort claim notice requirement for kids that are not in the custody of SCF or OYA and the injuries caused by SCF or OYA. It does not limit the tort claim notice for the juveniles that are in the custody of OYA or SCF where the injury is not caused by OYA or SCF. So it is extremely limited, but let me explain to you why this is very important. First of all, when a child is put in the custody of SCF or OYA, SCF or OYA for limited purposes are guardians of those kids. And therefore, we get into this legal circle where the guardian would be required to file a tort claim notice against themselves. If a tort claim notice is not filed, then the child would not be able to proceed with a tort lawsuit against the agency. So the agencies actually may have some conflict of interest there about whether to file the tort claim notice or not. Oftentimes, these children are represented by attorneys. For the Juvenile Rights Project, we have a contract with the state court administrator to represent juveniles both in abuse, neglect, and delinquency matters. Because our contract requires that we try to save the state of Oregon money whenever we can, our liability insurance is not through the PLF that's provided by the Oregon State Bar, but we get insurance through NLADA, which is the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association. That insurance, that malpractice insurance, is much less than the PLF coverage, but we are limited in what we can do as lawyers. We can only represent people for which we have the contract with the state for. Since we're a nonprofit law firm, we do not do any tort actions. So our insurer has actually told us that we are not covered by the filing of tort claim notices. We are not supposed to be doing that under our malpractice insurance. So then we get into this catch-22 circle where we know that a child that we're representing who's in the custody of the state, has had a tort because of the fact that they're in the custody of the state, and we cannot legally file the tort claim notices. So we must then find somebody who can file the tort claim notice within the period of time that the tort claim notices needs to be filed, which can be, it is 120 days, but that can be an extremely short period of time when you're trying to find a lawyer who will file a tort claim notice for a juvenile, because juveniles aren't always, especially the teenagers, the easiest people to get to have them sit down with somebody that they don't know and explain what happened. This would solve that problem. Therefore, that's why we think that this is necessary and we're in support of it. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Osborne. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wished to testify on Senate Bill 773? Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 773, being the work session this morning. We're going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 925. Council, would you give us a quick summary, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 925 comes to you from the Oregon Restaurant Association through Senator Minnis, and it deals with intoxicated persons and their ability to sue the server for injury sustained because of their intoxication.
Bill Perry, please. Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Chair Walker. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association. I'm the Director of Government Relations. Senate Bill 925 was brought to you as a result of two specific cases that happened in the interim. And in essence, in both cases, the Supreme Court remanded the cases back down to the lower court to overturn what we thought was the law of the land at the time, which is people that participated and drank alcohol brought suits against the people serving the alcohol. So what we're trying to do here is close a very specific hole that says that if you participate in your own intoxication, you cannot bring a suit against the server. This is not intended and will not address any of the third-party dram shop liability that if an innocent third party gets hurt, this does not address any of that. It was amended in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Oregon Trial Lawyers Association asked us to add a specific amendment to make sure of which we thought their amendment was already addressed, but they wanted to reinforce the fact that anything, if any property, a ripped carpet, a bad handrail, a broken stair contributed to the accident, that liability could still rest in the establishment. And we're fine with that. That is not our intent to limit any of those types of liabilities. This specifically deals with if somebody drinks alcohol on their own and hurts themselves, then that's what we're trying to address. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Are there any questions, Mr. Perry, at this time? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here that wished to testify on Senate Bill 925? I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 925. Okay, there's no work session on that bill today. We're going to move to House Bill 2551, open hearing on that bill. Council?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2551 comes to us through Representative Butler, and it deals with ex parte contact and agency officials. We just got -2 amendments that you should have, and I've received a lot of phone calls about this, but I think that almost everybody that's called me is signed up. We'll see at the end if positions haven't been explained. I'll go ahead and tell you.
Okay. Thank you, Council. Okay. Jenny Lang, please.
Excuse me. Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Lang, and I represent Quest. With me today is Larry Reichman, who represents our company before the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And I'm here today only to talk about the Dash 2 amendments. You may recall some months ago, I was here testifying on in conjunction with another bill, and it was pretty clear that that bill was not the right kind of a vehicle to talk about the issues that I had related to ex parte communications at the Public Utility Commission. Representative Shetterly was nice enough to help put together a meeting with a couple of representatives from the PUC, as well as Larry and myself, and Janice Krem. And I appreciate the effort that he made in facilitating that meeting. The effect of the Dash 2 amendments is to broaden the current Public Utility Commission ex parte rules to clarify that these rules apply to all parties in a docket, including both the staff of the agency and the representatives of the Department of Justice who also represent staff in the case. These amendments also clarify that the rules refer to or apply to all of the issues in the case. The amendments are necessary to ensure that parties in a contested case before the PUC are represented and treated consistently and fairly. Those are my comments on the Dash 2 amendments. If you have questions for Larry or me, we would be happy to respond.
Thank you. Do you have anything you wish to add?
Not at this time.
Not at all. Okay, she covered it all. Are there any questions, this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Janice Krem, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janice Krem. I'm chair of the Administrative Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. Our section is led by both attorneys who practice before state agencies as private practitioners as well as government-employed attorneys, so we have a balanced perspective on administrative law issues. Our section supports the original version of 2551. We have no objection to the amendment except to the extent that it basically limits the new requirements for the disclosure of ex parte communications to simply one agency, when we think the better view on ex parte communications in an administrative law setting should be an amendment to the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, or as Chapter 183, and in particular 183.462. Let's talk just a second about ex parte communications. In the judicial setting, ex parte communications basically prohibits secret communications with the judge in a case. There can't be communications outside the hearing of a party generally that to the decision maker in the matter. However, in an administrative hearing, that's a very different understanding of how ex parte communication works. In an administrative law setting, you are allowed to have secret discussions with the decision makers in the case. And we at the Administrative Law Section thinks that there should be less secret discussions and more disclosure about those discussions. The reason that it's handled so differently in administrative law settings is not so much because the statutory language in 183.462 requires it, but because of how it's been interpreted for the state agencies by their legal counsel. Basically, in an administrative proceeding under the Administrative Procedures Act, a contested case as they're known, the decision maker can have communications with agency staff about everything, what could happen in the case, how it should be decided, what they want to discuss about the case. And the only thing that they're really prohibited under the interpretation of the Attorney General's is communicating about things that are not in the record, and they can communicate about they can communicate about things that are in the record or about legal issues. That's an impractical standard in an administrative law setting for two reasons. Most of the people who are talking to the decision maker have no idea what's in the record or what is outside of the record. So they're put in a position of having to disclose under the current standard information that they don't know how to delineate. They don't know when they're supposed to be revealing it and when they aren't supposed to be revealing it, because it's a question of what's in the record. They don't preside at these hearings. They aren't the hearing officer. The staff who's talking to them rarely are the people who participated in that hearing. These folks don't review the record, and they're being asked under the current system to know what's in the record and to reveal when they're talking about things that are outside the record. It's just impractical. The other problem is, under the current standard, they don't have to reveal, agency heads don't have to reveal discussions that they have about legal issues. Well, it's very hard in any kind of a setting, including a contested case setting, to separate out facts and legal issues, because in this trial-like setting that is a contested case hearing, there's usually a mixture of facts and law. And so it's very difficult for folks who frequently are not lawyers, or even lawyers for that matter, to try to separate out discussions about facts and discussions about legal issues, because they're really mixed in these kinds of settings. So the current standard is pretty impractical. So I think that the reason we support 2551 is that we think there should continue to be discussions, but they shouldn't be in secret. There should be more disclosure. And the standard shouldn't be guessing whether it's a law or in the record or outside the record, but that there be open disclosure if it's important enough to talk to the agency head about. It's obviously important enough to tell the people who are involved in the proceeding that you're having those discussions. So less secret, more balance between disclosure and fairness. And we think that the original bill strikes that balance. It allows agency heads to have discussions with agency staff, but those discussions have to be disclosed so that if there's something about those discussions that the party needs to correct or respond to or at least know about, there's that opportunity.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Ms. Krim? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony today. Shelley Jensen.
For the record, I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon, and I'm basically just here to support the Dash 2 amendments. I don't have any additional comments to what was offered previously by the folks from Quest.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions of Ms. Jensen? Okay. Thank you very much. Kathleen Haley and Christine Schoet, or Schoet. Sorry, I think I mispronounced that. Schoet.
Schoet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. And with me this morning is Assistant Attorney General Christine Schoet from the Department of Justice. The Board of Medical Examiners opposes House Bill 2551 as originally drafted and does not oppose but has no objection to the Dash 2 amendments. Our concern about the original bill is that it would essentially do for a, what it would do is like a judge not being able to talk to their court clerk or a judge not being able to talk to the probation office prior to imposing sentence. Our board is a part-time citizen board, as are many in Oregon, and we would be unable to communicate with our board members once a licensee had requested a contested case hearing. In 90% of our cases, there is a settlement negotiated, and that comes to us usually from the licensee's attorney. We as staff want to be able to communicate those negotiation settlements with our board members. And because they work on a part-time basis, we have very little contact with them face-to-face and even periodic contact by telephone. So we need to be able to have that those kinds of conversations, which we believe House Bill 2551 as originally drafted would prohibit. I'm here to answer any questions that you might have about the board's position.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Ms. Haley?
Schut, did you wish to add anything?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
Please.
I'm Christine Schut, Assistant Attorney General from the Oregon Department of Justice. The section that I work in, the business activities section, represents most of the state of Oregon's small boards and commissions. Small boards and commissions are staffed by anywhere from one person to several people. This bill, as originally drafted, would have a significant impact, particularly on the smaller boards and commissions. For example, I have a client agency that literally has one staff member and five board members. I don't really know how a state agency with one staff member could bifurcate its processes so that the people involved in investigating and bringing complaints to the board would not be involved in discussing complaints with the board after or during the pendency of a contested case hearing. Obviously, the bill permits those kind of discussions, but it simply requires disclosure on the record of any discussions that do occur. What that means is that any discussions that staff would have with the board or with the ultimate decision maker would have to be disclosed, and party would have to be given an opportunity to respond to or to rebut those discussions. It essentially it chills discussions between board and staff, and I actually think that's what it's designed to do. It's not so bad when you're talking about a large agency that has many opportunities or many different ways to staff and flexibility, but when you get to a small agency, it makes it very, very difficult for them to conduct their business. In addition, the bill permits assistant attorneys general to have undisclosed ex parte contacts, if you will, with the agency decision makers. I think that's appropriate because primarily we'd be consulting with our clients on matters of legal advice.